Okay, thank you. So I'm opening this meeting, the July board meeting, and we're starting this meeting with eyeball reform. Rhianna, am I handing over to you?
Yes, that's right. Good morning to everyone, and you know, welcome to our one of our maybe our last discussion on eyeball for the time being. Agenda paper 14A. Deals with the feedback along with the staff analysis and recommendations on question three that was in the exposure draft. And within question three, there were four broad areas that got covered in the exposure draft. The first one was the remeasurement of the hedged item and the hedging instrument. We also looked at the amounts that were accumulated in the cash flow hedge reserve. It also dealt with, how the proposed amendments apply to groups of items, and then there was also some relief given for the retrospective effectiveness assessment. Now, the feedback on all of these areas were very positive, and people agreed with the proposed amendments, subject to some minor clarifications as we've set out in the agenda paper. There's only two areas I think we want to highlight at this point, and this is on the remeasurement of the hedged item and the hedging instrument. Some respondents did say that they would prefer not to recognize any fair value changes on the hedged item in a fair value hedge through or as part of ineffectiveness, but they would rather prefer to amortize that over time or over the remaining life of the hedge. And the reasons these respondents gave are set out in paragraphs 9 to 11 of the agenda paper. The staff is not recommending making changes to what was proposed in the exposure draft in this specific area, because the board already discussed this prior to issuing the exposure draft, and we felt that giving any exception from recognizing what really is ineffectiveness through P&L would be inconsistent with our previous decisions not to give any exceptions from the measurement and the recognition of ineffectiveness requirements. The other area I just wanted to highlight is on the retrospective assessment, the relief that we've given saying people need to reset the cumulative fair values to zero for the purpose of the assessment only, not for recognition, it's only the assessment. Although most people agreed with the proposed amendments, they did highlight that in some cases, our intended relief could have unintended consequences by actually forcing the hedge to fail, and therefore, you know, would not achieve the objective we've set out, and therefore they've recommended that we make that specific relief available on a voluntary basis or as an option instead of making it mandatory. And so therefore the staff is recommending to change that requirement so that we permit rather than require entities to reset the cumulative fair values. On the other areas, as I said in the beginning, we're not recommending making any changes, and we therefore recommend that the board confirm the proposals as they were in the exposure draft. And with that, I'll hand over to you for discussion and to see whether you agree with the staff recommendations set out in the paper.
Okay, thank you, Rhianna. Anybody looking for an opportunity to talk about IBOR and hedge accounting? Mary, you got a question?
I do. Sue, I do. Just want to check that you can hear me.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Rhianna, I had a couple of questions about the feedback and how we've how you've analyzed the feedback in the paper. I'm going to, I think the subject of hypo derivatives is something you want to come to next. So is that right? So I should just focus on the first bit?
No, we can, I didn't tee it up separately. So I think we can deal with them all in one.
Okay. Two things. One, in paragraph 10, you're explaining, and it's familiar from some of our other discussions, the feedback we got about people seeing mismatches between adjustments they make to the hedged item and the hedging instrument. And I was concerned about that until I got to paragraph 17. And I wanted to check that paragraph 17 was indeed responsive to the issue that's raised in paragraph 10 about the mismatches between the hedging instrument and hedged item. I thought that that was a very important point to bring out, because the issue discussed in paragraph 10 is quite familiar to us as we've thought about what is the economic equivalence and how are people going to get there. So at first it seemed like kind of a byproduct of that, but when you make the point in paragraph 17 about a significant difference from the remeasurement of the two items indicates that the reworking has left it with a disconnect, that certainly sounds to me like the ineffectiveness that we would want to capture through P&L. So I guess I'm just confirming that paragraph 17 is the response to paragraph 10.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And it's probably giving few heart attacks to have me talking about hypo-derivatives. But again, just checking my understanding of your analysis. So I'm looking, say, at paragraph 35 and some of the feedback we got about how some additional relief could be helpful. It came out quite strongly to me, and again, I'm checking my understanding here, that hypoderivatives are intended by us to be solely a measurement technique in terms of measuring changes in the hedged, either hedging instrument or hedged, in the hedged item, and that some of the changes that are talked about here are almost as if you're hedging the hypo rather than the hypo really being a measurement tool only. And the fact that it's a measurement tool only is the reasons why we're not creating any of the accommodations discussed in paragraph 35. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, that is correct. And that's also the reason we didn't want to, you know, give specific requirements or guidance around the hypo, because you know, the standard itself does not refer to the hypo or mention the hypo at all. It's just, like you say, a measurement technique, and the actual requirements apply to the hedged item, and so the hypo should represent what you're hedging in the hedged item for the hedge risk.
Have you finished, Mary?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to make a comment on hypotheticals as well, so I might just make that comment and then I'll let you in, Tadal. So on the hypotheticals, I agree with what you've said in the paper, Rihanna, and I think this has always been a difficult area for us, because when we worked on IFRS 9, it became apparent that there were some practices out there that were not what we had perhaps expected under IAS 39, where there was a bit of a practice of just assuming that the remeasurement of the hedged item could mirror the hedging instrument and that the hypothetical always matched. And we worked really hard on IFRS 9 to make it clear that it was just a measurement technique. And so I think I agree with your staff analysis. And what struck me in here was that my understanding, and I'm looking for confirmation from you of this, Rihanna, is that really what you need to do in terms of measuring your hedged item is to remeasure it for the risk that's being hedged. So the way that you work out your hypothetical needs to be based on what you're doing from a hedging perspective. And so unless you've actually changed something with the way that you're hedging your risk, you shouldn't be changing the hypothetical. Is that fair?
Yes, that is you know, how it should be, and that's what we were trying to explain in the paper as well.
Okay, thank you. Tadal?
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, the staff, for preparing the paper. It's a good one, very good explanation, very educative as well, because there are some very complex discussion here, and I think that it was well cleared in the paper. Just looking at the final amendment, that will include the relief as an option, as I understood, to be applied when needed. My reading of the paper is that this will be applicable on a hedge-by-hedge basis. I mean, no need to apply to all transactions if applied. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. And the reason we are making this recommendation is that when we initially developed the relief, the intention was to allow entities to make the changes to the hedging hedging relationships. And they had a good hedge before, and they would have a good hedge after making all these changes. But because of the ineffectiveness that could have built up during the period of uncertainty, it could happen that once they get out of this hedge, and the moment they then reassess ineffectiveness using a cumulative basis, that would have caused them to fail the 80 to 125 requirement in IAS 39. And we wanted to give them the relief from saying, well, you've already recognized all of that ineffectiveness, so you shouldn't really be now failing the hedging relationship at the moment that you exit the relief. But what people have raised in the comment letters is to say that in some cases that would be really helpful and they are very grateful for the relief. But there could be other cases where the instability in these rates and the volatility in the early phases of the new rates could actually, if you look at them on its own, that could cause the hedge to fail. But if you look at it overall, along with the cumulative changes of this relationship before, you know, then the hedge is still a good hedge. So that's why we think, you know, it's fair to apply this relief on a hedge-by-hedge basis when it's needed to keep the hedge alive. But it's only this requirement or this intended relief that would be voluntary. All the other relief that we've got in the exposure draft or that was in the exposure draft is still mandatory. So I don't think it would really affect the information that's, you know, result in less useful information if this one part of the relief is on a hedge-by-hedge basis.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I was going to... I agree with your staff recommendations, Rhianna. I just had a couple of observations which may or may not be relevant depending on what we end up putting in the basis as terms of explanations, if I could. So the first is on paragraph 28 of the paper where we talk about how the measurement works, and we've got references in there to IFRS 13. I think we need to be, if we have these sorts of observations in the document, I think we just need to be very careful that people don't overread what we mean, because my understanding of what we mean there is that if you've got a fair value hedge, you need to remeasure your hedged item for the effect of the hedged risk. So you're not remeasuring necessarily to full fair value, you're just remeasuring for the effect of the particular risk that you are hedging. And then when you're thinking about how to do that remeasurement, you apply the principles in IFRS 13. We're not saying that you measure it at fair value in total in accordance with IFRS 13. That, I think that's what you mean, but I think we just need to be careful to make sure that that's, you know, abundantly clear for people coming along, because it's a bit of a, you know, walking on a bit of a tightrope point. The last observation is in paragraph 48, it seemed to me that some respondents were really saying they thought that the relief that we'd provided in phase one for allowing hedge accounting to continue, even if you were outside 8125, should have a sort of a longer life, and that there should be further relief from prospective testing, even on a going forward basis. And the staff didn't go on that I could see to comment further on paragraph 48. My understanding is that we're not proposing to do what was requested in paragraph 48. Is that fair?
Yes, that is fair. And this is also something that, you know, we've discussed and the board agreed on when we were working on the exposure draft, is that the nature of the phase two relief we are doing is different from what we've done in phase one. And so there's, if we were to give any relief from the retrospective assessment, it would be difficult to put an end point to that, because at what point do you now stop applying the relief? You know, there's no clear link to what would be the end. And I think also because the intention of the phase two relief was to say, you are making these changes to your hedging relationships, and the intention is to get to a new hedge or a good hedge at the end of all of this. And so if you are at that point and you apply all of the requirements, you shouldn't really need any further relief from the retrospective assessment. And that's why we are not recommending making a change in that regard.
Okay, thank you. I don't think there's anybody else who has indicated they want to speak. So I think that we are ready to vote on the questions for the board. So it's just the questions in right at the end, isn't it, Rhianna?
Yes, it's on page 17.
On page
17. 17?
On 14A, mine looks like it's on page 11.
Oh, mine is on 17. but the question really is, the question is whether you agree with making the retrospective assessment, an option. So it's yep. permitting rather than require, and further to just confirm the proposed amendments in the exposure draft without significant exactly. change to them.
Yeah. So agreeing with the staff recommendations in paragraph 3. So can get a show of hands on that, please? Mary, are you supporting?
I am. I'm a yes.
12. Yep, we have 12.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Thank you. So that's everybody. Thank you. All right.
I have solved my problem, so I can resume leading the discussions. So we can go to paper 14B, the due process requirements.
Yeah.
Rhianna? Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So agenda paper 14B sets out the due process steps that the board has taken in developing the amendments to IFRS 9, I39, IFRS 7, IFRS 4, and IFRS 16. And seeks the board's permission to begin the balloting process for the amendments to those standards. Considering the feedback analysis and the staff recommendations on the ED at the June board meeting, and the feedback analysis and the staff recommendations set out in agenda paper 14A of this meeting, the staff believe that the amendments to those standards should be finalized without re-exposure. Appendix A to this paper sets out the due process steps taken in developing the amendments to IFRS 9, I39, IFRS 7, IFRS 4, and IFRS 16, based on the requirements of the due process handbook. In view of the steps that were taken, the staff believe that the board has complied with all the due process activities identified as being required in the due process handbook, and hence are able to finalize the amendment. And with that, I would like to draw your attention to questions listed on page 7 of this paper. The staff would like to ask you if the board agrees that our recommendation not to re-expose the amendments to those standards based on the feedback received and the decision made at this meeting. The staff would also like to know, in accordance with paragraph 6.23 of the due process handbook, if any board member intends to dissent from the issuance of the amendments to those standards. And finally, the staff would like to ask you to ask the board if it is satisfied that it has complied with the applicable due process requirements and that it has undertaken sufficient consultation and analysis to begin the balloting process for those amendments to the standards.
Okay, so let's first see who wants to, would like re-exposure. Do we agree with the staff recommendation to not re-expose? Can I see a show of hands?
12.
Is there anybody who would like to dissent? And I believe you don't want to dissent, do you? Or do you?
No. Anne, sorry, was your hand up to dissent?
No.
No.
Oh, Anne, you want to dissent?
I think she wants to dissent.
No. No, she doesn't.
Okay. So we have no dissent.
Do we give permission to ballot?
I think, is Anne not asking to come in and talk?
No. Anne, did you want to talk?
She does not want to talk. Okay.
Okay. Who gives permission to ballot?
And we have 12 there.
Okay. All done. Well, staff, you did a great job getting this done all in time.
So thank you.
Fantastic results.
Thank you.